Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With biodiversity still declining at unprecedented rates, the hunt for new strategies to combat the impacts rages on. One idea gaining more and more traction is to give legal rights to nature. This might sound novel, but it's actually nothing new. Ecuador became the first country to legalise the rights of nature in 2008, and an ever-growing collection of countries have followed. This includes parts of our environment here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, including the Whanganui River. With me now to discuss how this strategy could be utilised further is Dr. Victoria Kahui, Senior Lecturer in Environmental Economics at the University of Otago. Tēnā koe, Victoria.
Kia ora, how are you?
Good, thank you. Great to have your company this afternoon. First of all, can you define for us what granting a piece of nature personhood actually means?
Yes, thank you. That's actually a good starting point. Of course, it varies across cases, but generically, we could say that legal personhood is, if you think of a legal person, it can be both human and non-human. Human, obviously, have human rights, but non-human, think of an organization or maybe a charity or an corporate society. So a legal person can incur debts, be sued, own property, all those sort of things that you typically think of an organisation or a trust being able to do.
So when we think about parts of the environment having personhood, how does that work exactly?
So in our study, we looked at 14 case studies around the world. And of course, they're all very different in some ways, but quite similar in others. So this is not an easy and quick answer. But generally speaking, rights of nature, which is a generic term, acknowledges that nature has its own right to exist, something we call sort of an intrinsic worldview. And of course, Indigenous nations have advocated and known this for a long time. But I think in Western societies, we're slowly accepting that that's a valid point of view. So the rights of nature is really an explicit acknowledgement that nature has its own right to exist, flourish, and do well. Does that make sense? It does.
Give us some examples of personhood being afforded pieces of our environment here in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
So in Aotearoa, New Zealand, we have, I think, two and a third one coming. So as you already mentioned, the Whanganui River was awarded legal personhood. And that was in 2017 under the Te Awa Tupua Whanganui River Claims Settlement Act. Prior to that was Te Urewera in 2014, which was a former national park. And soon to come is the Maunga Taranaki. So these are the three examples in New Zealand.
Talk to us more about what protections have been afforded Te Urewera or the Whanganui River as a result of their personhood.
So it's very early. I think what you're alluding to is how effective these sort of legislative changes have been, if that's correct.
Because yeah, absolutely.
There's not like extra protections in place per se. Currently, but what happened is it's kind of shifted the whole mindset away from a river like the Whanganui River being pretty much administered or used and abused by the councils for gravel extraction, steamer service, and so on. And now with the river having its own, being its own legal person, it is actually guarded by its guardians, one from the Crown and one from the Whanganui iwi, with an advisory board that, you know, with all kinds of stakeholders, Meridian Energy to recreational and commercial fishers who have input into the management of the river. So I think it comes down to having a voice, a representation in decision making, and not being so much subject to just decisions made at upper level. And for the Whanganui Iwi, of course, it's an explicit acknowledgement to their link to the river and them having a part or some voice in managing that river. If that, yeah, does that kind of answer the question?
Yeah, it sounds good. Yeah. So when we talk about the process for granting an ecosystem personhood, can you take us through what is happening with Taranaki Maunga, for example, at the moment?
I'm sorry, I can't really answer much on that because it wasn't in place when we did the study, and we actually focused much more on a global comparison. And we looked at 14 case studies ranging from Spain, Man Manor Lagoon, to the El Rio Atrato, which is a river in Colombia, to Ecuador, as you mentioned. So we kind of did more of a comparison across those 14 case studies and had a look at, well, first of all, who advocated on behalf of these natural entities? What was the economic pressure, the purpose? And what were the legal design? How did they vary? And this is kind of what we focused on, a much more broader view. And it's really fascinating. I mean, the one thing that they all have in common is that it was very difficult for them to fight against the sustained economic pressure, may it be from mining companies in Ecuador or for in the Man Manor Lagoon, most recently in 2022, tourism, agriculture runoff, and so on. So it was the sustained economic pressure that kind of over decades led to eventually with local communities and indigenous advocating on rights of nature. But when we look at the design and how they're implemented, they actually vary widely and hugely. So in Ecuador, it was enshrined in its constitution. But if you look at, for example, the Whanganui River, it's a legislative change. There was a law change. And it also varies widely in who advocates or who is the guardians of this river, because obviously you need some sort of guardian or some entity speaking on behalf of these natural entities. So, you know, in Ecuador, every citizen can basically go to court and speak on behalf of Mother Nature, while in the Whanganui River example, we have dedicated guardians who support the river. So it varies quite widely across these case studies.
Victoria, I'm interested, of the 14 case studies, and what an extraordinary effort your study's gone to, was there anything or any examples that really stood out to you and your team?
Yes, so, you know, when we thought about it, I mean, ideally we would like to say rights of nature is the answer to biodiversity loss. But we can't say that because, first of all, many of these rights of nature case studies are the result of complex historic grievances and conflicts. And ecological outcomes are often neither defined nor measured. So we can't say, you know, this particular incident has changed or has improved an outcome. But what we can say is we looked at the differences, and the two cases that stood out were the cases where both these cases were overturned. What that means is, for example, Lake Erie, which is in the U.S., there was a bill that awarded the rights of nature to a lake, and the adjacent farmers went to court and challenged that decision based on the fact that it wasn't clearly defined what a violation of these rights would mean. So they argued, well, you know, we will try to reduce our fertilizer usage, but we cannot completely avoid that fertilizer running into the river. So, into the lake. So what does that mean? And what are we liable for? And eventually, due to, you know, vague laws, that decision was overturned. That was an interesting example. And the other interesting example is the Ganges and the Yamuna rivers in India. Now, they are quite unique in that they awarded not just rights of nature to the rivers, but actually treated them like a human person. So we call them living rights of nature. So an injury to a river is equal to an injury to a human person. And that's, of course, throws up all kinds of legal questions. And in India, the state of Uttarakhand, who administered this particular rights of nature decision, went to court and to the Supreme Court and said, look, you know, we don't know what happens if someone drowns. Are we liable for this? Do we have to pay compensation to the family of the victim? So based again on that liability issue, that case was also overturned. And that gave us quite a bit of an insight that, you know, liability measures in the sense that what constitutes a violation of those rights and, you know, who is liable.
I don't have the answer to that, obviously, Victoria, but I wanted to just ask you one more question to close. For this approach, granting personhood to pieces of the environment, for it to grow and make a real difference, what needs to happen, do you think?
I think New Zealand is unique. I think we, with the Whanganui River, we have really, and Te Wera Wera, we have really set a precedent. And actually, a lot of the case studies, such as the Magpie River in Canada, are modeled on the Whanganui River legislation. And what that has shown is that attention to detail matters. So it has to be a very clearly legally defined legal personhood. So, you know, it's also very important to, I think, use the framework of a legal personhood. So really, you know, define them explicitly as a legal person rather than generically as rights of nature, and really specify who are the guardians and what are they liable for. So in New Zealand and Whanganui River example, the guardians were treated as a charitable trust for tax purposes. So they have clearly defined liabilities and rights. And I think that is important. And they're also financed partially by the government. And that is also important because, you know, you need to make sure that sort of entity is sustainable, financially sustainable. So me and my co-authors, Claire Armstrong and Margrethe Andersen from Norway, we kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, legal details matter, I think.
Good speaking with you this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Victoria Kahui there, Senior Lecturer in Environmental Economics at the University of Otago.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.